For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The debate over reopening schools has been emotional and difficult. After all, we're talking about our kids. Well, after lots of work, Maine now has a plan for fall. Today, we're going to discuss it. Joining me, Pender Macon, who is Commissioner of Maine's Department of Education, and Beth French, an elementary school teacher at East Belfast School, who is president of RSU 71 Education Association. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you eager for your students to go back to school? Are you worried about what it might be like? And what do you think of online instruction? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us. Commissioner Macon, the latest guidelines just out last week are going to give school districts guidance. They're advisory, but not rules. Explain to us how your thinking went and outline some of the broader points of these guidelines.
Sure, yeah. So over a month ago, we put out a framework to guide the planning for restarting school in the fall for all districts. And that included comprehensive bulleted items around pedagogy and ideas around hybrid learning models and methods and social emotional learning, academic concerns and considerations, all of that. But also it included a spot for health and safety guidelines. And at the time, all we had was the national CDC's guidance, which has been notoriously fluid, and it, you know, disappears and it comes back in a different form somewhere else. It hasn't been very consistent or reliable. So we are delighted to be able to report that last Friday, our own Maine CDC and public health officials and epidemiologists at DHHS provided us with a list of very concise considerations, guidelines, and a few absolute like requirements in order to be safe restarting school in the fall. I'm happy to expound further.
Yeah, so explain. I think that what's really interesting is that you've made the choice to categorize schools by county and give them a green, yellow, or red light evaluation. Tell me what those mean, what they mean from the CDC's point of view, and what they might mean to the school districts.
Yeah, sure. So the CDC has developed a very complex matrix that takes into account a number of factors, including percentage, positive rates, hospitalizations, symptom trends throughout the communities. And they are going to be able to provide an assessment that will be updated biweekly beginning on July 31st per county. And that would indicate that external community public health risk is either in the low category, the elevated category, or in a high category for that particular county. And in a green or low risk category, there are certain essential safeguards that still must be implemented in order to have in-person education provided safely. And in many districts, we've been emphasizing all along that there are two sets of criteria that will go into a decision around what is safe and advisable. So on the one hand, there's the external public health measure. And on the other hand is the internal capacities and logistics and facilities within a district or a school setting that would allow them to meet these essential, required guidelines from CDC. When those places meet, that's great, and you can have in-person instruction safely. And in the event that in a green or low-risk county, a school district is unable to meet the bare minimum requirements, which are they're considerable, and when I go through those, you'll see why. I mean, they're expensive, they're logistically challenging, and for multiple reasons, they're going to be a challenge for all school settings. Schools may be opening in a hybrid model in the fall in the event that they're unable to fully implement those required pieces. So it could be a green county with schools still opening in a hybrid, some students in and some students not in at the same time, kind of a model.
Okay. I want to bring you into the conversation, Beth. I know that not just here in Maine, but nationwide, teachers have tried very hard to have their voices heard. How are you feeling about plans so far for fall?
Thank you. So, yes, I definitely have heard quite a bit of concern coming from both our teaching staff as well as our support staff. And the concerns are varied and great. I mean, primarily it's health and safety issues of course, staff, because we're also parents and caregivers. Certainly our students are always in the forefront of our minds, and making sure that we're able to meet the needs of our students at all times, and then of our community as well, because we are community members. So getting sick, transmitting this virus, that weighs very heavily on educators' minds. Also of concern is the availability of personal protective equipment, making sure that we have that before going into our job site, into the classroom, behind the wheel of a bus, working one-on-one with students, making sure that we have that PPE available is a very, very big concern right now. Also of concern is student ability to comply with all of these CDC recommendations and those requirements that have been outlined by the Department of Education, because of the nature of the developing brain of children, just their developmental nature of being able to understand this virus and the potential risks associated with this virus, and then all of the sensory issues surrounding complying with wearing a mask and keeping that mask on for the health and safety of themselves and for the students that are around them. I'm also hearing quite a bit of concern surrounding if and when educators become sick. We've faced a sub shortage for several years now, and that has been an ongoing struggle to find, we call them guest teachers, that will be able to step into classrooms. And so that's operationally, we're at a disadvantage because we've been working in the midst of a sub shortage. So that is weighing heavily on our mind. And then also, because educators are parents as well, if we work in one district and we live in another district and those two districts have very different operational plans, there's the complication of the child care needs. If your children are on a different routine and schedule than your district plan, how are we going to meet that need as well as all of the other accommodations associated with going back to your workplace safely if you do have those safety needs in mind of different health concerns that you have personally, just being able to have those accommodations met. So there's generally a lot of concerns that educators are facing that are weighing very heavily on our minds, but the students are really in the forefront of all of that concern,
right?
And just being able to return safely.
Pender, Beth has outlined really, really well a lot of the concerns around this entire debate. Why don't you talk about the other perspective? Why, if you heard all of the concerns, somebody might say, why on earth are we even considering sending children back to school? Tell us why. Why are we not just saying, you know what, we're going to go back to online education for another year?
Right. Well, thank you for that. And I think I would first want to honor and acknowledge all of those concerns that Beth has listed there. Those are shared certainly by the Department of Education, by all of the administrators and administrative team and groups throughout the state, many advocacy groups and so on. So we all share those very same concerns. So I wouldn't say it's the other side of it so much as it is. And additionally, we have many concerns regarding the health, well-being, emotional, social, behavioral, and academic development of children, particularly those children who are already more vulnerable than the rest of the population and who have access to far less enriching life experience and good nutrition and adult interaction outside of the home. And so there is a public education has always been an extremely challenging, I would put out there, nearly impossible mission. And day after day and year after year, somehow these daily miracles are accomplished by our educators, our school administrators, and the communities that support our schools. So it's really, really difficult. And just want to acknowledge that first. We do have the concern, though, that public education is a covenant that is between, you know, our educators and school administrators and school leaders and school boards and the communities that we serve. And throughout all of history, in the most dire circumstances, when entire societies are you know, harmed and suffer unilateral harm, schools and groups of children being educated, it's one of the first steps in healing and recovery and economic recovery and hope for our future. So we can't just say it's scary and dangerous, so we're not going to try. I will say, however, that we are committed at the Department of Education. We're committed to opening schools in person as soon as it is safe to do so, and not before that. So, and the governor and all of our teams, the CDC, DHHS, we all share that same commitment. We won't be opening schools across the state until it's safe.
Calling in now is Dora Mills, who is Chief Health Improvement Officer for Maine Health. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Mills.
Hey, it's good to hear your voices, and including the others on the show. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, some of the debate over reopening schools centers on the idea that children are at low risk of getting COVID-19. What is the medical thinking about this?
Well, there has been evidence emerging in the literature that shows that children may be less likely to infect others, and this may be especially true of younger children, those under 10, and that schools do not seem to play a major role in community transmission as they do with influenza, and that rates of COVID-19 infections seem to be lower for children than for adults. And if exposed to the disease, that children may be less likely to become infected with COVID-19. So again, that's emerging evidence. And then there was a major study out of South Korea that was published over the weekend that showed they were did contact tracing on tens of thousands of people in South Korea, including households that had children. And it seemed to reinforce these emerging thoughts that I just mentioned, but particularly for the younger children, for children under 10, and whereas teenagers seem to be as likely perhaps to infect others as adults are, and or at least as likely. So in coincidence with that, or concurrently with that report, the National Academies of Science, the part that was formerly known as the Institute of Medicine, came out with a report of the head public health and infectious disease experts, as well as educators, that said for in-person education, that perhaps this evidence points towards prioritizing K-5 and special education students. So kind of interesting emerging evidence that I think we're all, you know, every week that goes by, we're all learning more about this infection.
All right. I want to talk about the various safety measures that we're all talking about, which is keeping physically distant and wearing masks, especially about wearing masks. Can children wear a mask all day at school effectively, do you believe?
And you're asking me, Dora.
So, yes.
Yes. So, yes. In fact, we have a lot to learn from schools that have opened up several months ago, in fact, from in other countries, including Denmark and Norway and Japan, as well as some schools that have opened up earlier than us in this country, as well as daycares that have stayed open across the country, especially for essential workers, including in New York City. And in those settings, it seems to be that, you know, children are a little bit more malleable than we are as adults. You know, we're all struggling to wear those masks a lot, and yet it seems like kids are seeming to adapt to them a lot easier. especially, you know, kids over two. And that was the U.S. CDC recommendations and the American Academy of Pediatrics are for children over two, particularly to focus on wearing masks. Now, realize that, you know, not all children are alike, and there are some children, especially those with special needs and others, who may not be able to keep a mask on or some kind of behavioral health needs, that, and that's true of adults as well. So there's certainly, but I think what we can look at is these protective measures are like layers. So masking and distancing are the two major strategies. But there's also things like putting up barriers, like at those tables that kids sometimes share in a school, possibility of putting plexiglass barriers up between the kids, cohorting, identifying a stable cohort of students and teachers who stay together all day long and had their separate time on the playground, for instance, hand hygiene, environmental strategies, just making sure that assessing the ventilation of the school and assuring that it's at its optimum amount, and screening kids and staff also and faculty every day for symptoms and making sure that they're not coming to school if they have symptoms. Mm-hmm. So all of these are layers that, as many layers as you can add on, the better that everybody's protected. But not all schools and not all children, not all teachers can adapt, you know, implement all of these layers. But, you know, distancing and the face masks are really the primary ones, if at all possible.
Dora, since I've got you on the phone, I'm going to ask you a question that's come in from a listener. This is an email from CK. I am a public elementary school art teacher. When all kids are present, I see approximately 350 kids per week. At this point, I am assuming I will most likely be on a cart bringing materials to each class. A question I have regarding art supplies, can students share supplies such as paint trays, brushes, scissors, markers, or should we plan on getting unique sets for each child? Or do we need to clean supplies between classes, which is not very realistic but doable for some supplies?
Yeah. Now, that's a great question. And, you know, I'm bringing the public health perspective. So clearly, you know, this is a big elephant. So the public health perspective is just one, and it needs, you know, even all these public health recommendations, it needs educators, parents, even students, you know, to figure out what makes sense for their situation in their school. And this is kind of an example that, yes, from a public health perspective, you would want to, you know, limit so that the students are only using their own, you know, supplies. So if it's like crayons, that they use crayons and that those crayons stay with the student. But I realize, you know, that may not be completely possible. So I'm washing down crayons in between use. It's probably also not very, very possible. But I think there are ways in which, you know, if you have a set of them, for example, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, so it's not going to come out really, really well. But if you have a set of crayons that you use for students one day, and then you let them sit for a day, so you're not washing them off, and then they can be used by another set of students a couple days later, because the virus doesn't live very long on inanimate objects that is in a viable way, in a way that can be transmitted. So that's kind of a, you know, one idea. We all have to kind of look at all the evidence and then become creative, I think, and figure out how to implement these. But I just wanted to just mention, though, the number one thing we can all do is, as I think Commissioner Macon mentioned, and as she mentioned, is that it's all about the levels of community transmission. What we know from other countries and other states repeatedly, that when the pandemic activity is low, It seems to be safe. It seems to be very safe to open up schools. But when the transmission, the activity of pandemic is very high, you're going to see a lot more outbreaks in schools, and it's not as safe. So the most important thing we can all do to help reopen our schools this fall is to wear our masks, keep our distance, and wash our hands, the three W's, because that's going to keep our pandemic activity low in Maine, and that's going to increase our chances of getting schools reopened.
Dr. Dora Mills, thank you so much for calling in. Dr. Dora Mills is with Maine Health. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Rising Tide Brewing in Portland, celebrating summer on its outdoor patio with beer, wood-fired pizza, oysters, and more. By Big Moose Inn on Millinocket Lake, family-owned and operated for 45 years, BigMooseCabins.com. And Maine Community Foundation, working with donors to expedite funding to nonprofits in this unprecedented time. Learn more at MaineCF.org.
Our economy is in crisis. Is it time to rethink the role of business in society?
In this moment, we're realizing what we value, who we value, and how connected we are to each other.
Join me, Manoush Zomorodi, and TED's Corey Hajim for ideas about the future of business and questions we need to ask about what we value. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus is on a twice-a-week schedule on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On these 2 days, it will normally happen at 2 o'clock each weekday afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, the briefings are archived at MainePublic.org for later on-demand viewing or listening. Just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is normally scheduled for Tuesday and Thursdays each week and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, sorting through the many cost-benefit issues of returning to school in the fall. Joining me, Beth French, who is president of RSU 71 Education Association and a teacher at East Belfast School, and Commissioner Pender Macon with Maine's Department of Education. We invite you to be part of the conversation. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Eric, who's calling from Windham. Hi, Eric. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. I'm a public special education teacher, and I guess what I wanted to start with was I work with a population of very high need students. And I have yet to hear any explanation for how we can safely work with these students, given that they are unlikely to consistently wear a mask. They require close proximity. They have behaviors that require physical holds. And some of their behaviors are particularly dangerous. So, for example, you know, some interfering behaviors might be spitting on staff. And so I think we're required by federal law to provide, you know, equal access to education to these students. But when we're discussing reopening schools, I rarely hear realistic plans for how we can provide a safe education to these students while respecting the safety of staff and teachers, some of whom are not paid very much, ed techs, you know, and they're going to be asked to kind of put their lives and their family lives at risk.
Eric, excellent question. I'm going to turn to Commissioner Macon. Go ahead.
Hi, and thanks for the question, Eric. This is one of the many extraordinarily difficult challenges that we're all going to have to face together. We know that there's a much higher level of PPE equipment and protection that will be required for educators who are working under conditions where they would have to have close proximity to students or would have to assist students with medically necessary, physical interventions. So there is that. We know that the department has been working with NEMA and our school safety center to procure for school districts, everything including face masks, the cloth masks and disposable masks, some masks which are see-through, the kind where you can actually read lips and read facial expressions while also wearing a face covering. And then also there are the face shields for those students who are unable to safely or effectively wear a cloth or other preferred face covering. And then for educators who are in those positions and for school nurses. There would be additional, for example, goggles or eye protection and gloves and those paper gowns, even to the extent necessary. Those are all being procured and they will be delivered to schools. Most of the equipment and supplies will be there in early August, and then additional shipments will be coming near the end of the month. And so we're predicting that we'll have what you need equipment-wise to keep everyone safe.
Eric, thank you so much for your question. Calling in now is Stephanie Clisham. She is a rising sophomore at Hampden Academy and a member of the Department of Education Student Cabinet. Thanks for calling in, Stephanie.
Thank you.
You've heard some of the options for returning to school. Where do you come down? Are you more worried about the health risks or not concerning or not returning to normal instruction?
Well, I mean, I think I'm kind of a happy medium of both. I mean, the health risks of students and staff is obviously a big concern. However, personally, I really want to return to, in classroom instruction because, I mean, personally, I have a very extroverted personality and, you know, seeing my friends and being social is important to me. And I think I can speak for a lot of my friends as well when I say that.
How do you feel about remote learning? You had to do that in the spring.
I'll be honest. I personally didn't struggle that much, but I know a lot of people that did, like my brother, for example. He just was having a hard time staying on top of it. And even me, I mean, I didn't have a hard time getting my work done, but I didn't feel like I was learning as much as I should have been.
All right. What would you like to say to the adults making these decisions throughout Maine? What would you say to them?
Well, I mean, thank you. Like, I think it's important to keep, you know, our students safe and our staff safe and keep everyone safe while also being able to just get the best out of our education and get the best out of just being in school, because to a lot of people it's really important and it's actually fun for some students.
Well, Stephanie, thanks for calling in. That's Stephanie Clisham, member of the State Student Cabinet and a rising sophomore at Hampden Academy. Beth, we talked briefly about remote learning, and I'm wondering from your perspective as a teacher, how was remote learning this past spring, and how would you feel about returning to it in the fall?
Thank you for that question. This has really been quite a topic of conversation amongst my colleagues for quite some time. I think that educators really rose to the challenge and to the occasion. I mean, we had very little time to prepare for the realities of COVID in late March. And literally over the weekend, educators reinvented how we deliver instruction, which I believe was nothing short of miraculous. I am very proud of my colleagues. I think one of the things that was a silver lining in this was that it really helped us to focus on relationships with families as we were delivering instruction via Zoom and the different digital platforms that we were provided with. We also had an opportunity to talk very regularly with our families and make sure that children's social, emotional, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that they were being provided with nutritional services. So I really feel like although it was a challenge and it was really an emergency learning situation because we were kind of thrust into the reality of the situation, I'm just incredibly proud of the work that was accomplished by educators all around the state. Certainly there's always room for improvement. And I think that all of the wonderful resources that have been provided through the Maine Department of Education with their ongoing supports and webinars have just also been a very valuable tool in addition to the resources that have been provided through our state association, Maine Education Association and National Education Association. So I'm very proud of the work that was accomplished.
Joining us now, Carrie Woodcock, who's Executive Director of the Maine Parent Federation. Thanks for calling in, Carrie.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell me about the discussions that you're hearing among parents when we're thinking about whether or not to send kids back to school in the fall.
Sure. So it's important to note that Maine Parent Federation represents parents of children with special health care needs. So the large majority of our special education population and 504 populations within our school districts. And so our parents are all over the map in regards to expressing their concerns about their children getting access again to in-person social and emotional and academic learning. Some of our families have seen large amounts of regression because they just weren't able to access the virtual learning. Not that it wasn't a good model or that the efforts weren't made on behalf of our local districts, because they were. Some of these children have such high needs, they just weren't able to access those types of models, regardless of the efforts that were made. So those families are concerned about ongoing regression if virtual or even hybrid models continue. But then we're also hearing from families who have children that are immunosuppressed and at really high risk for coming down with this virus and becoming very sick and the potential of death, and saying that they're not going to return their kids to school until there is a vaccine and they can ensure that their child won't get sick. And we represent everything in between. So we're trying to provide a voice for all of the concerns that we're hearing from these families. And it's a wide variety.
It sounds like no matter what your perspective is, there's really important points, really important considerations on multiple sides of this issue. Thank you, Carrie, for calling in. Carrie Woodcock with the Maine Parent Federation. We're going to go to Lauren calling from Old Town. Hi, Lauren. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm really interested in if there's been conversations at the state level or within districts about incorporating more outdoor learning this school year, because the risk of transmission is so much lower. And I'll just put out there that there's a lot of folks in the state that work in outdoor ed through nonprofits or summer camps or higher ed. And we're definitely willing to help and help schools pivot to more outdoor learning if they're interested.
Pender, has this been discussed? I know other states have been talking about this. I mean, obviously, it doesn't work in February, but it might work for a couple months.
Right. Well, actually, it could even work in February. We have a lot of examples in Maine, as just mentioned, and also within our public schools. There are many adventure-based learning programs and alternative programs. And what I can say is the department is definitely eagerly exploring these options as alternative safe ways to meet the needs of students and to help them to grow and develop in nature and you know, maybe have their learning augmented in that way. We recently drafted a proposal for a large grant that we hope to make available, assuming we are awarded it through the federal government, for alternatives to what people think typically of remote learning options. And we actually highlighted outdoor education as one of our preferred models for folks to explore. So more on that, fingers crossed that we receive that funding from the federal government so that we'll be able to foster these types of options for kids.
And a question from Debbie, based on the red, yellow, green designation, given Maine's low numbers now, are any counties even designated as red at this point? And if so, what would they need to do to be moved to yellow? My understanding, Commissioner, is that the first rollout of the green, yellow, red designation will happen July 31st?
Yes, that's right. July 31st is the date where we anticipate being able to post our first risk levels for community transmission. And I can say this, what I would be careful about is making any type of assumption that would not be subject to dynamic change. You know, just having spoken with my colleague in Arizona, she's the commissioner of education there, and just a couple of weeks ago, they were preparing to go back to school because they go back in the middle of summer when it's too hot to be out. And they were ready to go back full on everybody. And here they are now, their entire state is shutting down. And there's not even any type of assumption that they'll be back in class anytime soon. So the virus is very dynamic. We have been incredibly fortunate in Maine. And I'm so proud of the folks at CDC, DHHS, and the governor and her office and team who have really seemed to keep Maine relatively safe as compared to the rest of the nation, but I wouldn't make any assumptions about our bubble lasting any particular length of time.
All right. Well, we're going to go to Barbara calling from Farmington. Hi, Barbara. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wanted to make a comment about what Dora Mills said, is like kids are resilient,
and can learn to wear a mask, but she's really downplaying how realistic it is that they can do that for 6 hours when the way they're going to be taught will look a little bit different. I'm a fifth grade teacher in Farmington, and my kids are always out moving around, going over to other kids' desks to ask for help, borrow a pencil. Those things can't happen. We're just going to have to totally rethink how the classroom works. So she made it seem like it would be easy. It won't be easy. It'll be worth it. I want to see my kids, but it won't be easy.
And Beth, I bet you agree.
I do. I completely hear where you're coming from, Barbara. This has been something that I think families can really be working on at home right now. I mean, we still have a little bit of time, and I've been working with my own kids on the desensitization process of, you know, first you start with the mask and you feel the mask and you wear it for a little length of time, and then you build up their tolerance to wearing it. Different children have different sensory needs, but I agree with you, Barbara. It's a process, and families can be supportive of that now by helping with that conditioning.
Barbara, thanks for your call. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We're talking about schools, K-12 schools, and the fall. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners manage summer heat with air sealing, insulation, and window replacement services. More at evergreenyourhome.com. By New England Cancer Specialist, committed to excellence and now a member of the Dana-Farber Cancer Care Collaborative, newenglandcancerspecialist.org. And Encore Renewable Energy, committed to fueling Maine's economic recovery with solar energy for businesses and institutions. Encore.eco.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Animator Ruthie Thompson was born in Portland on July 22, 1910. Her family moved to California in 1918. As a child growing up in Hollywood in the 1920s, she lived a short distance away from the fledgling Disney Brothers studio. Thompson's technical mind led her to be named supervisor of the scene planning department at the Walt Disney Studios. She was one of the first three women to be admitted into the Hollywood Camera Union. After working on virtually every Disney animated feature, Thompson retired in 1975.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Ernst & Schur and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
Nationalism has played a role, both good and bad, throughout our history. In today's world, can it be a force for good?
The most troubling manifestation is the rise of deeply authoritarian nationalists all over the world.
I'm John Donvan. The value of nationalism in modern times, next time on Intelligence Squared U.S.
That's coming up after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we are discussing the debate over how to best approach fall in K-12 education. My guest, Maine Department of Education Commissioner Pender Macon, and Beth French, who's a teacher in Belfast. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now is Eileen King. She is Executive Director of the Maine School Superintendents Association. Thanks for calling in, Eileen.
Good afternoon, Cindy. How are you? Hi, Pender and Beth.
Each school district in Maine is allowed to make their decision, their own decision about whether to reopen or not. Is your sense that superintendents are generally on the same page, or do you foresee very different scenarios from district to district?
Well, I think in talking to the superintendents across the state, the superintendents, all of our staff, all of our educators, are very, very eager to bring their students and their staff back to school. However, that being said, we know there are a variety of concerns that superintendents have. So they are planning, they are developing three different plans, one for an in-person return based on the CDC guidance, safety precautions, one for the yellow or the blended return, and obviously the red plan, which is the remote only. So they are working right now on developing all three plans, and also for each plan having protocols for a variety of different scenarios, the quarantine rooms, cohorting of students, screening students and staff, hand washing, sanitization. How are they going to handle visitors? How are they setting up their classrooms for social distancing? And what are the school buses going to look like? And what is lunchtime going to look like? And face coverings? And how are we going to handle the students that maybe that can't wear face coverings for a variety of reasons? So right now, superintendents are developing plans to address all of those scenarios. And their goal is to reopen if possible providing a safe environment for all students and staff, following the CDC guidelines and trying to have a minimal impact for families' schedules as much as possible, being flexible when needed. But a lot of tough decisions are being made, and there's a lot of anxiety about making the best decision to keep everyone safe.
And at what point do you believe most reopening decisions will be made? Will parents know what's going on?
I think a lot of templates and maybe draft plans are now being rolled out for community input and for staff input. And then once the guidelines come out as far as the metrics on July 31st, that will also be another benchmark as far as decision-making protocols go. And I think we need to continue to look at the science and the data. One of the things that's also concerning to superintendents is that if you're in a school district in a green county, the setup of your building, the configuration of your building and the age of the building might require you to come back in a yellow as a yellow district, mm-hmm. Because you can't accommodate the safety, the required safety precautions as you are expected to. So there's a lot of straddling between green and yellow plans and a lot of protocols being developed for all of the things that need to be addressed by superintendents.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for calling. That was Eileen King with the Maine School Superintendents Association. We're going to go now to Pius Ali, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Pius. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
Go ahead. What are your concerns? Yeah.
Yeah, my concerns are that I work here at Muskie School with a program called Portland Empowered. We are a program that engages families who are immigrants and also who normally do not get engaged by the school system. So we create opportunities for them to engage the district. Recently, I met with a group of parents from across the state who are mostly immigrants, and there is a lot of anxiety on what is this going to look like. So my question is, if the commissioner is there, is there any plan to specifically reach out to these communities and tell them this is what will happen? These are some of the, some of the services that we put in place in case things don't go. There's a question of technology. There's the question of our students. The students in our communities are falling behind already, and then the pandemic have made it worse. Does the state have any plans to mitigate that?
Great question, Pius. Yeah. Pender?
Yeah, I just want to add that Portland Public Schools already reached out to us, and we are having a back-to-school forum 2 days next week, and I hope all the other districts will do that with those communities.
Hi, Pius. This is Pender, and yes, I couldn't agree more, and I know that our Black, Indigenous, and people of color in general in Maine have suffered a disproportionate impact from the COVID-19 epidemic. And the Department of Education is deeply committed, as are the superintendents and school administrators across the state. We are definitely committed to meeting with and getting engaged with populations who are experiencing a disproportionate impact and trying to find innovative ways to ensure that every child is as safe and moving forward in their education as absolutely possible. So we, if we haven't reached out yet, we have a group at the department who is either already reaching out or planning to reach out in the very near future to those communities. And it's right on the top of our list of concerns.
Pius, thank you so much for calling in today. We'll go to Jason, who's calling from Thomaston. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Oh, good afternoon. I so appreciate today's show. I wanted to know if today's educational system allows for a flexibility that might include like personal hygiene and a collective strategy for minimizing the impacts of a viral disease. I want to tell you, and I'll shut up, but my four-year-old called, and he was asking me questions about the behavior of viruses. His dad said, oh, he just saw 45 minutes on the Internet. I think these are our allies. And instead of parents training children, children will come with the good information, science-based. Oh, Mom and Dad, we don't do that anymore in school. Let me tell you what our strategy is for that countertop there. Anyways, I'm optimistic about the future, but only if education shows flexibility.
Jason, thanks so much for your question. Beth, I think every parent has experienced what Jason's talking about, where they're learning things from their children.
Oh, certainly. I definitely hear that quite a bit. Educators are very novel at meeting student needs. So, I mean, we certainly have curriculum parameters of what our day looks like. And then we have these shining moments throughout the day where we just teach students at their point of need, which is really, I think, one of the joys of teaching is just really teaching the whole child based on whatever needs present at that time and what is meaningful in that context. So I just appreciate that question, Jason. Thank you.
Sarah on Facebook writes, I'm a middle school band teacher. I, along with many fellow music teachers, are very concerned that guidance from the Maine DOE simply recommends to, quote, suspend choir and wind instruments. We have had to be exceptionally creative to reach our students in the last few months. We're music teachers consulted about how we may be able to provide instruction in a safe manner. It seems like a slippery slope for a content area that is often at risk in normal times. Pender.
Yes, and we have heard from many, many music teachers regarding that particular bullet in the larger considerations checklist. It's not part of the absolute requirement, and I think it comes directly from the national CDC, and we recognize that as we go forward, many of these first attempts at putting out general guidance will have to be honed and made workable and reasonable for Maine schools. We deeply value our music programs, and I think we will be providing updated guidance around specifically singing in groups and wind instruments in the very near future.
All right. Catherine in Freedom, New Hampshire. Hi, you're on Maine Calling. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a special education teacher, and I'm moving with my family to Maine, hoping to teach in the fall, though I don't know what district I'll be in yet. But I'm in an extended school year program right now and teaching in a hybrid learning model where I see some of my students in person and some of my students online on different days. I want to validate everything in this conversation and say that my experience with hybrid learning has been fairly positive so far. My students are those high-need students that sometimes do need hands-on physical intervention, and we've been able to get the PPE we've needed. And even with my students that are low verbal or really have complicated learning profiles, we've been able to help them be safe and keep themselves and their peers safe. So I'm so glad that Maine is having this conversation in July and that the same things that my school has worked through and continues to work through are on everybody else's minds as we all work to teach all of our kids and keep ourselves safe.
Catherine, thank you so much for calling. I want to go to an email from Libby. I'm very worried about the safety of returning to school, but also having our youngest students stay at desks 3 to 6 feet apart is wildly contrary to what we know is best practicing for educating children. It will increase behavior problems and interfere with learning for many kids. Will it even help by the time if we're all in the same poorly ventilated room for 6 hours? Pender, thoughts about just the best way to be educating younger kids? And if they're all spaced out, does that work?
Well, so as I think we've heard multiple times, none of this is going to be easy, and none of this is the ideal for educating students. Everything that we do in public education, or much of what we do, is geared around, is structured around crowd management and control, like having a lot of children at one time in one space doing an activity together is, you know, part of what we do. So certainly it's not going to be easy, and we are going to have to support school districts with innovative approaches to educating students while also directly educating them around maintaining physical distance from others during a school day during a pandemic. We like to think that this is not the go forward forever. And we do know that it can be done. And we know that because across the globe, there have been successful and unsuccessful attempts at restarting school programs. And we are keeping our finger on the pulse of all of those examples. And what we know is that even though it is unfathomable for some people to imagine children wearing masks, for example, during the day, it has happened, and it has happened successfully in many places already. So we're trying to take the lessons that we can. Similarly, physical distancing, those two pieces, really the three things, hand washing and hygiene, the physical distance and the use of face coverings are the three things we know for sure will mitigate the impact of this virus. And so we need to teach children how to do those things, and then also how to learn and be joyful and curious while also maintaining safety in those ways. It's going to be hard, but we're going to be there to support all of the school districts in the state.
All right. And we'll end with a tweet here from Marty. We are blessed to have a great superintendent and great teachers in Biddeford, but this one isn't going to be easy. We have five scenarios modeled, and they're all pretty disruptive. Meanwhile, my seventh grader just wants to ride the bus and go back to school. So I want to thank my guest today. The voice you heard just a minute ago, Commissioner Pender Macon with Maine's Department of Education. Also with us, Beth French, president of RSU 71 Education Association and a teacher at East Belfast School. Be sure to look out for Maine Public Reporter Robbie Feinberg's ongoing coverage of how schools are responding to the pandemic. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Maine school districts try their best to plan for fall. Usually, summer is a time for teachers and administrators to first take a break and then do their planning for fall. But it's really hard to plan when you don't know what to expect. Will school buildings have to be reconfigured? Will classes be online? If so, what about the students who depend on school for meals or support? And can kids wear masks all day? I'm Jennifer Rooks. The State Department of Education recently came out with its recommended plan for school reopening. It outlines different scenarios for different counties, categorized by the prevalence of COVID in each. The plan is meant to be advisory in nature and will be updated every 2 weeks. What are you hoping back to school will look like? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update.